Really embrace failure. When you fail, like that's just another opportunity. I think early in my career, I was terrified of failing. Now, the way we manage our team, we call them tuition payments. It's
Okay.
if you fail today, that's fine. We're going to learn from it. We're going to talk about it as a team. How did we get here? Why did it happen? How do we prevent it from happening again? And then we just chalk it up to a tuition payment.
Welcome to Beyond the Ledger, real conversations with people driving business forward. I'm Troy Ashby, CPA and host. Each episode, we unpack stories, challenges, and insights from today's top accounting and finance leaders. This podcast is brought to you by my friends over at MarketScale. Welcome to the Beyond the Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Troy Ashby. Today's guest is Johnny Aiken, owner of Floor Coverings International. He's a CPA, a former Deloitte senior manager, startup CFO, growth phase COO, and startup president. Turned entrepreneur and owner who's built, restructured, and scaled businesses, Johnny's a self-described jack of all trades, master of none. He enjoys time outside, watching sports, and spending time with his family. Johnny, nice to see you, bud.
What's up, man? How are you?
Not bad, not bad. Thanks for joining us today. I know my audience is going to learn a lot from you. You've got several pivots and quite amazing career. So before we get into, you know, your career and everything, just a little icebreaker. Why don't you tell us something that we can't find about Johnny on LinkedIn or out in the world of the internet?
That's a wonderful question. Lots of faith, failure, continued learning throughout my entire career. I think there's times that it comes all at once, and there's times that, you know, you get one of the three, you know, coming at you really hard. And then there's sometimes everything's going great, you know. But I think I have been through different journeys of faith, right? Ultimately, sometimes it's really strong, sometimes it's, you know, on the weaker side. But ultimately, I find that when you're failing most is when your faith is strongest. And ultimately, you always got to want to learn something new. Try to become the best jack of all trades you can possibly be.
Yeah, jack of all trades. I it's funny because I guess, you know, we met 10, 12 years ago. And you're kind of that, you know, jack of all trades, renaissance guy back then. But I think, were you at Deloitte probably then, sitting as a senior manager?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess, so why don't you talk to me about why you chose the accounting career before you went where you are today? And we'll kind of get to the evolution of things, because I think a lot of the people I talk to every day, they come to me as a manager, a senior manager in public accounting, and they're realizing that, well, I thought I was partner track and now I'm not. But I want you to rewind and then we'll come back to that later.
Yeah. So, you know, partner track, I was on it. I was one of those guys that ultimately was committed to the firm. I've always been an extremely loyal person, especially to folks that are willing to put time into me and mentor me. So I had the opportunity to advance, you know, at Deloitte, ultimately spent time in their national office, was preparing my resume to ultimately be a partner, preparing partner presentations and that sort of thing. And then ultimately it was going back to faith. I had, you know, some time to really think about whether or not that was what I really wanted to do. Had three young children, married, obviously, and was really struggling to find how that all worked for me to go and coach their, you know, baseball, soccer, football, whatever games, and be the dad that I wanted to be. And so ultimately, you know, goes back to faith. I prayed on a lot, and ultimately, as I'm going through partner presentations, telling those folks that mentored me and tried to get me to that spot, I basically told them I didn't want to do it anymore. Also had an opportunity to join industry in a startup as their CFO. So I mean that helps having an opportunity out there.
Sure.
So let's
talk about that, because I mean, it's hard once you're there, what, 11, 12 years. Mm-hmm. And what group were you in at Deloitte? And were you an auditor or the tax side?
I was audit, but at that time, our CEO was really pushing cross-functional professionals. So basically having auditors assist on consulting teams, and auditors assist on tax teams and advisory teams. So as I came out of national office, that's what I was really trying to do, is be that cross-functional professional.
And so, because that's the number one thing that I hear all the time is you're an auditor, you haven't touched the GL, or you've done tax, but you haven't seen it all. And so you're saying, so on that consulting side, were you actually going in and on a fractional level, or were you still just consulting on the like high level projects or some new pronouncement? What did that look like?
Yeah, it was a little bit of whatever kind of came from consulting teams. Like, as I left, I was in the real estate practice. The time I spent in national office was a specific real estate management development program, where I traveled around the country and talked to groups of people, some as large as 300, about new accounting developments in real estate. But basically leveraging that knowledge as I left national office to support consulting engagements and advisory engagements and tax engagements. And it could be any question. It could be, hey, what does this pronouncement mean to my client? Because they're consultants. They're better with process,
Sure.
not accounting pronouncements. So what does
And
that sound
how,
like?
so you your next step is this startup. So how did you go from Big Four, mostly large national Fortune 500 companies, I'd assume, plus the consulting? What did you do? Everybody's listening right now is like, how did he go? I would love to be a startup CFO. Like, what steps did you put? How did you find it?
A lot of it is relationships. The guy I went to work for had founded a company called Callbox Storage. He was my first senior at Deloitte. So I think a lot of
Wow.
times, you just continue to manage those relationships. We were golf buddies, always enjoyed being around one another. We could challenge and have very honest conversations with one another instead of, it wasn't groupthink. It was like we embraced each other's ideas, that sort of thing. But yeah, I think as far as opportunity and why I wanted to go after a CFO of a startup was the opportunity to kind of take process that was kind of ingrained and drilled into you within the Big Four, especially at that size of client, and integrate that and ultimately implement that at a startup. Because I think that's oftentimes where startups fail, is they're drinking from a fire hose and forget completely about process, completely forget about mission statement, completely forget about, the ultimate purpose and getting everybody aligned and going in the same direction. They just are, and that's where Callbox was whenever I joined.
That's what I was going to ask. So were they pre-revenue or had they already been operating and then you kind of came in to say, all right, good, we're making money at the bottom line, but let's put this together a little bit more so you can make some decisions.
Yeah, I mean, we were ultimately making money at the top line. Whenever I joined, we had just come off of a partial year where our revenue number was, I think, 50,000, and then quickly grew to 750,000 the next year, then 1.5 million, then three. And I mean, it was one of those kind of double trend lines. But yeah, I mean, it was extremely challenging. But yeah, it's extremely important to get everybody on the same page and have processes and that sort of thing. And I was a one-man team whenever I arrived,
Right.
Don't really have a lot of team members, but it just teaches you a lot about all the process stuff that you learn in Big Four. It resonates all over the place. It resonates in a startup space. It resonates in that kind of next level growth phase. It resonates, when you're trying to sell to private equity. It resonates all along the entire kind of path of a growing business.
All right, so you're a senior manager when you left and you went over there. Then you became an accounting and finance department of one. Were there challenges that came along with that, either for you or for your leader? Like, talk to us about those. Like, what'd you wrestle through, or you were just perfect?
No, absolutely not perfect. I think the thing that was hardest for me is really understanding what you don't know. Like, I had been kind of in really big company space where honestly employees are very siloed into specific tasks or specific roles. I was not used to, and even in Big Four, when you're managing a team, everybody has kind of their role or their section of the
Right.
balance sheet or
Yeah.
their, whenever I, became a team of one, you're quickly doing everything. But it ultimately taught me that you've got to really build processes where you're duplicating work. You've got to build a process around it. And you've got to try and automate as quickly as you can. My CEO was one of those where he did not want to pay extra G&A costs because we're trying to get the bottom line positive, right?
Right.
So he expected a lot out of me individually in cranking out financial statements and cranking out reports or, anything where we were trying to raise money for investors. Like, that was really on me. It didn't have multiple departments or anything like that. So you quickly just realize how many different things can go on, and ultimately you've got to learn them all.
So you're wearing a lot of hats, and before then, who was wearing those hats, right? But it's interesting. You talk about processes all the time, and when I, when I get engaged with these, whether they be startups or early growth stage companies, it's one of the first things that almost none of them have, because they're surviving, they're growing, and they're trying to keep up. So the processes are very important. I'm guessing that's kind of what led you into that next step, because you evolved. You went. Because we talked a little bit about back then, you kind of moved into a COO seat and kind of backfilled yourself or split yourself or something. So is that what happened? Like the processes and operations just were appealing?
Yeah, that definitely helped. I think what helped more is I always enjoyed leading teams at Deloitte. That was one of my favorite things to do, was figuring out how to accomplish a massive task as a team. And when I had the opportunity post-COVID, we had just lost our COO, and one of the holes that I had seen was we needed to kind of refine process and across everything operationally. And I just had the opportunity to do that. So I went to the CEO and I essentially asked, I was like, hey, one of my favorite things is leading larger teams more than, a smaller than average accounting and finance department. So I kind of pitched myself to be the COO. Luckily, in a small company, you had the opportunity, even as the CFO, to do some operational tasks. So I wasn't completely going in blind. So yeah, I just really wanted to go after managing more people, and leading larger teams. That's ultimately what I was after.
And so what was that timeline between CFO and leading the big team, or maybe what happened in between there?
Yeah, so from 17 to 20, I was the CFO. From 20 to kind of 21, I was CFO and COO. And it quickly was, I don't like having bias in roles, especially as an executive, So whenever I'm the COO trying to, ask for more cost, and the CFO on the other side trying to save cost, it was one of those situations that just made it really difficult for me to be successful at both. So, yeah, I essentially asked to not be the CFO anymore and go full steam ahead at CLO route. Yeah, I mean, there was definitely transition. It wasn't one of those things that you just kind of wake up the next morning and you're the COO. It just doesn't naturally work that way, especially if you're, the same person within the same organization.
Yeah. All right. So, accounting and finance. Now you're moving into operations. And how big is your team at this point?
At that point, we had locations in Dallas, Houston, Austin, Phoenix, and Seattle. And the operations team was probably 30 people. And each one of those locations had an operations manager. So the operations managers were my direct reports. So yeah, ultimately there was turmoil. You can imagine, COO is leaving. And trying to get everybody else on board with, hey, the new guy coming in who was the CFO.
Right.
There's definitely some challenges that you learn through that, but
Is there one that stands out? Is there some challenges that you feel like, somebody might be able to take this and say, okay, this is coming. Maybe they can learn from this one thing.
I mean, the biggest thing, I've always been a a very kind of people person. I enjoy kind of the coaching and development of people. But I have learned throughout my career, like, your instinct should always trump anything else that you believe. From a business perspective, I certainly had instincts and that gut feeling about some people. I wish I would have pulled the trigger a lot sooner than kind of waiting around and trying to coach them. There's just some people that aren't coachable. And in those situations, you got to pull the trigger quick.
You and me both are bad at that, or have learned over time. What have you put anything in place that helps, you know, make sure that you don't let them stay on too long? Is there something you've done to identify or to protect yourself from yourself? You know, okay, maybe this person is not going to cut it, and I wish them the best.
There's two triggers that I kind of pulled near and dear. It's responsiveness and being on time. If your executive officer is reaching out to you and I don't hear from you, you know, in a period of time, sometimes if I think that it's an urgent issue and I don't hear from you within, you know, an hour, I'm going to ask why. Some things, you know, you're a little bit leaning on, but it's really those two things. Like, if you can't be there on time, which is super easy to do if you're a little bit disciplined, and if you cannot be responsive to me as your executive and boss, like, I'm sorry, you know.
Isn't it interesting? You're talking about all things that they can't control, right? It's not the skill or the intelligence. It's those intangibles that, and actually you can't control. You, Johnny, cannot teach it, right? That's good. No, that's really good. All right. So from the time you started to the time you left, how big was it when you left? And let's talk about kind of moving on to ownership. You can talk through all the things in between, but I'm excited because I haven't heard much about this and we haven't talked about it for a couple of years. And so I'm excited to hear what's coming up, but talk to us about the upcoming transitions.
Yeah. So in 2021, I essentially went to our new CEO at the time. I went to our existing CEO and had a sit down conversation. I was like, hey, look, like, my parents are aging. I want to get back and be closer to home. Luckily, we have markets, you know, that are in Dallas, Austin, Houston. And I want to move right into the middle of all three of those. And it was embraced. They were like, yeah, that's great. We need to focus on those three cities anyway. The expectation would be that you would commute and go and be in each one of those cities, you know, at least once a month and continue to help develop the operations. At that time, we probably were towing 100 employees.
Okay.
And both on the logistics front and the normal call box storage front, we were approaching $10 million in revenue. And then ultimately, we had a CEO change. So strategy, as you can imagine, when you change a CEO, changes a little bit. I was already completely committed to moving toward the Central Texas area. And then, you know, post-COVID, expenses and cost of operating a business, especially in the storage space that we were in, was going out of control to the point where, you know, a $10 million business, you would think that should be cash flowing pretty healthily. But there was one segment of the business, specifically our storage segment, that was not doing very well, mainly because of just cost. You had cost in vehicles. We're about 5 years old now. Legacy vehicles are starting to turn. We need to find new ones. It was extremely hard to find new ones. Employees that we used to start, you know, at that $12 to $15 an hour range are now asking $25 to $30. Warehouse space that we existing, you know, we would have rented at $5 a square foot per year is going up to $10 to $12. So quickly we realized that just metrics on the P&L, specifically in the storage business with these really large warehouse spaces, was really hard to make the numbers work. So new CEO basically said, okay, Johnny, I'm okay with you moving, but we're going to be restructuring that set of business. So I need you to lead that effort. which basically means we're closing some of these markets. We're going in, we're laying off a lot of employees. We're restructuring it more toward the logistics side than the storage business. So that was kind of my last and final task before moving on to the next thing.
Not everybody's had to go through, you know, layoffs, let alone large layoffs. What was your thoughts there? How what did you learn, or how did it feel? How did you execute it? Because that can't be easy.
No, it's not easy, but I think you just have to be completely honest with people. And every room that I walked into, I said, listen, after this is done, I'm going to be a casualty too, right? I made that upfront and clear from day one. Every time I walk into a room and said, we've got a lot of tasks ahead of us, I'm going to need your help along the way. And oh, by the way, when we're done with this, we're going to treat you right. We're going to do everything we can to find a really good landing spot for you. And it always helped with me kind of finishing that line with, when I'm done too, you know?
Yeah.
Because then I was a member of that team that was going through that, and we were all going through it together. But ultimately, we had to go city to city and have a plan that we executed against to ultimately get material back to customers or over to, you know, a company that basically bought our book of business in some markets and go through that transition. But I mean, it's all based on a plan and a process that you execute in.
All right. Enough about those. let's move beyond. I'm starting to get a little like, that's got to be a hard, I guess I'm kind of just relating to it. Like I just, the people side is, I mean, they're all people. Treating them like humans, but, and it sounds like you had to do it the best way you could, but that's always a hard thing. And people go through it every day. I mean, it just happens every day. All right. So talk to us about what's next. Where'd you transition? Now you've moved.
Yep.
And you know, closer to family, mm-hmm. and you've had a couple more things, but so what was next?
Yeah. So ultimately, life is a lot about relationships. I had a really good college friend of mine call me, and he basically said, listen, Johnny, I know you've been in the startup space. You've launched a company from almost zero. You were along the ride, definitely with an executive team, getting a company from zero to almost 10 million. Well, not only do I want to do that once, I want to do that twice, with two different companies. One was in the porta potty and dumpster rental and service space. And then the other one was in equipment rental. So call it, you know, cat bulldozers and bobcat skid steers, that sort of thing. Ultimately need to go out and build two companies around those two concepts. So
are these going simultaneous?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Going at the same time. So recruiting a team for both of those, launching platforms for both of those, and basically, you know, being there from the foundation, the setting up of the legal entity all the way through to growing those two companies to a point where, you know, they operated for a good while, but there was other things going on behind the scenes within the family office that I wasn't completely privy to, which included a company that needed a lot of the family office's resources to get it turned around with a lot more leverage on it. So I ended up becoming the CFO of that company. So I kind of took the focus off of being a founder and president of two startups, just really turned over the leadership to the team that I had recruited on those two companies, and then became the CFO of basically another restructuring opportunity.
So. Full circle back to your roots. All right.
Yeah, extremely challenging. As I saw it from day one, the company that needed restructuring, I was like, man, this is going to be really, really hard. Even harder than what I had done at Callbox.
And size-wise, I mean, were they similar in size, or were they still down at the startup side? Or
this company was close to, they were approaching $20 million in revenue at one point, and then they were down to $7 million.
Okay.
So
all right.
A lot of the growth came from acquisitions, or storm work. It was a mitigation and restoration company, so we were storm chasers. We went to hurricane ravaged areas and helped rebuild. I mean, ultimately, when you have a company at its peak and you go and get leverage at its peak, and then it's dipped down to $7 million in revenue, you can kind of paint the picture on what we've got to go through to ultimately get it turned and restructured.
Yeah, so sitting in the CFO seat for the family, you're for at the family office at this point. All right. And I mean, family offices are all unique, but you have family dynamics, right? But and they've got everything that they've got to go on. Where did that end? Were you able to was that something that was an extra challenge that you were able to learn as you kind of figured out these one or two companies through the family office and what those dynamics look like as the fixer? You're right now you're the fixer, right?
That was probably one of the more difficult times in my career was really that stop, because I'm working for an extremely good friend of mine, literally my best friend in college, and you start just learning things about him, you're learning things about family dynamic, everything. Very, very good, grounded family. But what you learn in the family office space is there's sometimes there's things that you know about and there's things that you don't. And sometimes net worth of the family is the most important number. And you don't have any visibility into that. They had built some really cool special things. And then ultimately, when I saw kind of we were working on a book to ultimately sell the company, a majority interest in the company. Yeah, I just got to a point where I was like, okay, I can see the writing on the wall. And we were beginning to have to furlough some folks, and me included, to the point where, yeah, I just was like, I can't do this anymore. And decided to frankly do my own thing. So,
And here we are.
yeah, here we are.
And how long's it been now? And talk to me a little bit about the company. When did you actually buy in at this point?
Yeah, so we launched Four Coverings International, started going through the process in November of 23, and then initially it was just a side investment that we were going to have. Wife and family members were going to run it, and then it quickly kind of became a full-time opportunity for me, and we ended up launching Open for Business kind of towards the end of March of 24. And it's been just go, go, go since then. It's one of my firm beliefs is, yeah, if you're going to do it, just go. Go as fast as you can.
Well, and by this time, when you really all the things we just talked about, all the things that you've gone through to this point, who's more prepared than to put processes in place and see all the things and mistakes and all the things that you've learned that other people have done? But what exactly do you guys do? And talk to us a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, so we own a franchise called Four Coverings International. Four Coverings International, our specific location is one of the larger geographic franchises within the network. We cover a territory that goes from Austin, almost into the suburbs of Houston, covers Bryan College Station, and captures a big swath of land here in Central Texas. The great thing about it is it's a high growth territory. If anybody knows anything about Austin that's listening, Austin is continuously growing. Austin has grown, to the west about as far as it can, and now it's starting to grow to the east. Interest rates have impacted it a little bit, but we looked at it as a long-term investment, where we're buying a massive territory of land in a high growth area of Texas. Where, if we can build a base business, there's a massive opportunity to for us to ultimately be the largest franchise in the network. So the great thing about Four Coverings International, if you ever do your research on them, we're the highest rated flooring company in North America. We operate out of the mobile showrooms, so it goes back to my time at Caldlox, really spending time in homes, in being a mobile storage solution. Well, now we're a mobile flooring company. We basically take samples in the folks' homes and help them select floors in their house instead of them running back and forth to big box stores trying to identify the floors that they want. So, I mean, that's kind of the basis of the business. By it being really highly rated, and what I mean by that is not Google ratings. I'm talking about Net Promoter Score ratings. We are off the charts in service from a Net Promoter Score standpoint across the entire network. So I quickly realized, hey, these guys are onto something.
Yeah. For those that aren't familiar with Net Promoter Score, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so Net Promoter Score, it's basically a Google review that you can't lie. Google reviews, you can basically ask mom, dad, grandparents, your kids to go and throw up a 5-star review, right? Net Promoter Score is a lot more random. We take our Net Promoter Score in three phases of our business. One is really that initial reaction with the customer or the initial interaction. The next is when we're in the home, actually preparing a proposal. And then the last step is really when the customer is actually a customer. We've actually installed floors for them. And the way Net Promoter Score works is it's basically a scale of 1 to 10. And it's a, hey, how did we do? Scale of 1 to 10. And I'm oversimplifying this, but basically a 7, 8, and a 9 on the Net Promoter Score scale is a promoter.
Okay.
Anybody kind of in that mid-range of 5, 6 is a, they're not a promoter. They're not a non-promoter. And then anybody in that 1 through 5 is not a promoter. They're the middle folks are called passives. The guys kind of in that 1 through 5 are not non-promotes. But basically what Net Promoter Score is doing is it's essentially taking all of your promoters and you're averaging that out over the non-promoters to come up with a Net Promoter Score. If you see somebody with a 70, 80, 90, Net Promoter Score, those are really, really good scores. Like Costco is 75, I believe. American Express is in the 30 to 50 range. I mean, there's really big companies out there. And the key is you definitely want to be positive, right? But if you can find companies that are in that 80, 90, that is elite. And Floor Coverings International, system-wide, we're at like 88. Our local location is still sporting 100. So I'm a huge fan of focusing in on Net Promoter. But that's a long-winded response to your question about
But that's good. I mean, I've heard of Net Promoter Score. I've known that, my company, we need to probably look into it, but I hadn't really done enough to look in, and maybe the other people hadn't either. So, but it gives me an idea from a customer standpoint too, of what that really means. So that's good. All right. So let's go back to the flooring. Cause there may be somebody here that's like, yeah, I'm down near him. I need to get some flooring, but what is flooring? Like, is there something you're limited on? What do you specialize in?
So any kind of hard surface, soft surface flooring, we don't do like epoxy floors or stained floors. We always refer that business out. But any other type of flooring, we take it on. We'll do, rubber gym floors, for weight rooms, that sort of thing. Hardwood floors, carpet, obviously, but basically anything flooring, we're going to be pretty well involved. We do a lot of repairs on subfloors for folks. Now, if your foundation is cracked, we're not your person, but if you're in a pier and beam house and you have rotted subfloors, yeah, we'll come in and fix that stuff. But yeah, the unique thing about us is we have a larger kind of brand around us, Floor Coverings International. All of us together, if you add all the franchise owners, we're about the 6th or 7th largest flooring company in North America. And then you get the local touch. You have owners that are extremely involved. For flooring, I mean, if there are any listeners that are interested in flooring, we're offering 10% off. I actually have a consulting firm that I work with as well. There's a partner of a few guys. And we actually will do free discovery as well for any of the listeners. We're honed in on process, as you can imagine, helping companies develop mission statements and then ultimately, we're the entire group of us are extremely organized around business and just ultimately trying to take the folks that are, drinking from a fire hose, and help them really elevate their business to a point where they're able to sleep at night, frankly.
I mean, I've enjoyed this so much, and we need to actually spend some more time catching up. But the last question, because like we kicked off earlier, starting in the accounting, you got your CPA, you went in public. But that pivot, I'm just curious, if somebody wanted to move into, whether it be a startup or go out and own a business, what is one thing that they can do 5 or 10 years before that you've learned that maybe they could take away?
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day. The one thing that I wish I would have done in my 20s and 30s a lot more was read. Read a lot more books. Because I mean, you can find, a lifetime of knowledge in one book. And one book, what does it take you to get through? Especially audiobooks these days, you can get through a book in a week, easily. Especially if you're commuting, that sort of thing. Steal as much knowledge as you can from the people that have spent lifetimes putting them into pages, and yeah, leverage it. I think that the thing that, as especially at Deloitte, like you rely so much on the folks around you. But once you join industry, especially when you're in the startup space and it's you are it, you've got to rely on a lot of knowledge and experience. And I wish I had a little bit more that those first few days at Callbox, because those were by far the hardest. But yeah, I think that's the one of the biggest things. And then I guess, Troy, the other thing is really embrace failure. When you fail, like that's just another opportunity. I think early in my career, I was terrified of failing. Now, the way we manage our team, we call them tuition payments. It's okay. If you fail today, that's fine. We're going to learn from it. We're going to talk about it as a team. How did we get here? Why did it happen? How do we prevent it from happening again? And then we just chalk it up to a tuition payment.
That's genius. I love that.
But you just got to run at it, and just go as fast as you possibly can. I think. Family probably I annoy them. Like if we go on family vacations, I'm always walking really fast. I do that everywhere. Like I'm gonna walk really fast because I think it sets a stage for the folks that are around you watching you. It sets a stage for how you're gonna operate in life. It sets a stage for how you're gonna grow your business. I know that sounds super, maybe even dumb, but I walk really fast.
It's funny you say that. I also walk fast, but I think it's because I'm maximizing in my head, I'm maximizing my time.
You're absolutely right. Time is like the one thing that we only have a certain amount, while we're here, and you got to use it as best as you can. And I choose not to use it walking. I'm gonna walk real fast
There you
and get
go.
to
I
from
mean, you
point
could
A to
start
point B.
running instead.
Yeah.
I too wish I would have read younger. Now I can't get enough, and there's not enough time to catch up, but I can't get enough, whether it be an audiobook or a paperback, or sometimes it's both, audio when I'm driving and pick up the book. And I think that's brilliant, because I think that nowadays there's so much instantaneous ways to get knowledge that there's not as much reading that could be done. Could be accomplished. I mean,
For sure.
I've appreciated you coming on the show.
Yeah, you
And
mind if I ask you, what are you reading right now?
oh my gosh. So I'm actually going through, I wish I actually used to have it behind me. I'm boring book guy, but I'm rereading Traction. So I've been I mean I've read it once. Actually, it was audiobook the first time, and so now I'm going back through and doing it in paperback, because it was too hard to process via audio. Yeah, what about you?
So I'm actually trying to make it all the way through the Bible right now. But yeah, Traction is a really important one. I gave a little mini presentation on Traction literally last week. We have a networking group that we're a member of that, and Traction is kind of their book of the month, call it. And we we're not 100% on traction, but yeah, I mean, just implementing a little bit goes a long, long way.
Yeah, I think the EOS system is really important. I've tried to read the Bible front to back 3 times, 3 years in a row. Are you using the app? The follow along? Yeah. I feel like that's almost more intimidating because once I get too far behind, I feel like I can't catch up. I just should just roll it forward, but it's such a great way to do it. But I failed 3 years in a row.
Yeah. Well, I'm about 150 days in. So
yeah,
not quite halfway, but yeah, it's a 365-day plan. But yeah, you just got to, I'm a little bit behind too. So
see, that's the problem. You feel behind, but you're not. You've gained so much just by reading.
Yeah.
For the 150 days. Yeah. And it's more than a lot to do. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. It's been great. And, you know, try to get down your way and see if we can't get together.
Yeah, likewise. I need to get back to Dallas and visit you guys.
I'm Troy Ashby. And remember, people are more than their titles and companies are more than their balance sheets. Follow Beyond the Ledger so you never miss an episode.